David, what brought you to the podcasting world, especially based on the paper that you wrote for the National Academy of Education?
Thank you, Rich. First, and this is not a setup, you brought me into the podcasting world. I had never thought about doing podcasts until you had asked me to do them for the Learning First Alliance. My willingness to respond to your current request that I consider doing a podcast series related to the paper was based on my respect for you as a good man, as a policy person, as a practitioner, but also because I knew you did good podcasts. My experience with the podcast was informative and enjoyable, and I hope they will be the same for everyone. When you asked me to do the podcasts, I realized that the podcast could enable people in the field, practitioners, policymakers, family members, organizers, and community staff to benefit from the paper's implications and to listen to people who are deeply knowledgeable. I've spent the last 50 years dividing my work among research, practice, and providing advice to policymakers across the country and the world. And in that process, I've learned from a great many researchers, scholars, and practitioners. At the same time, I've observed that people who are trying to do good work and want to do good work in the field really can benefit from the types of people whom I've had the privilege of learning from. I also observed that they are rarely afforded the opportunity to see the entire elephant that they are dealing with. So this podcast series is really aimed at providing people who want to do good work and often are really doing good work in the field, in schools, in communities, in community-based organizations, in agencies, to be able to harness the best knowledge, to appreciate its nuances, and to be able to apply that knowledge as reflective practitioners. I want them to be able to practically use the knowledge in a way that can support deeper learning and thriving for young people, for people who work with young people, for families and communities, and to provide and support equity at a time when equity is particularly challenged by COVID, by the politicization of issues that relate to science and to the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and also in a world where people's lives are challenged by the rise of AI.
David, you're now touching on essentially some of the core ideas that are presented in the first set of three episodes of the podcast series. How do you want to expand on those ideas?
The first episode introduces these issues. It speaks about the need for equity and the fact that the need for equity has been a long-term policy issue in the US. It also talks about the fact that there is a robust evidence base that can be harnessed in a practical way. But in order to harness that knowledge base, it has to be translated and made operational. And that must be done in a way that reflects a whole variety of voices and perspectives, and not one voice or perspective. There are also other issues that have dominated educational and mental health discourse in our country and in the world for decades, and probably for a millennium. And that is the tendency to separate pieces that ultimately are connected. That has particularly happened in the US, which is a bean-counting culture. We do lots of research on important things, but we tend to single out and do not address the fact that the effects that we talk about discerning and then identify as effects are not the product of any one thing. They're really vectors that are the dynamic property of many things that continue to emerge. This podcast series is about unpacking the contributors to those vectors, but to do it in a way that does not complicate things, but enable people who are struggling in what Donald Schoen once called the swampy lowlands of practice, and what Michael Huberman once called busy kitchens, to access that knowledge with sufficient clarity and understanding so that they can act right now, so that they can support student learning, particularly deeper learning, and support student well-being in ways that lead to student thriving and contributes to equity, and to do so in a manner that not only helps young people thrive, but enables the practitioner to also thrive, both emotionally, cognitively, and spiritually, in terms of knowing that the work they are doing is meaningful and consequential. These podcasts are also for people who face lots of cutbacks and lots of nastiness. I want them to know that they're not alone, that there's lots of good people who are doing lots of good work right now, and they are people who can support them both directly and virtually, so that we all can work together to support the young children and families in our country and in the world so that they can thrive.
David, in constructing these episodes and the parts of the episodes, you made an important shift in the structure, in that you changed from talking about school to school and community learning activities. Why did you do that?
A fundamental principle of the science of learning development is that learning takes place 24/7, wherever people are, and that learning is both always individual and at the same time, it's always social and cultural. If we want to support student and adult learning, we have to understand that learning does not just take place in the schoolhouse at certain points of time. Learning is always taking place. And what we want to do is to be able to both create nurturant learning ecosystems that support every young person and every adult in learning and thriving, and at the same time, to do so in a manner that is sufficiently aligned and coherent so that the learning opportunities reinforce each other, both affirmatively and also function both as backups and amplifiers rather than undermining each other. This is important for several reasons. First, everything that happens in a learner's life affects their learning. And if things don't cohere, they can undermine that learning. Second, cognitive and emotional reserve is finite. Coherence creates conditions where people don't have to spend lots of time trying to figure out how to navigate between different places. Instead, they can spend that cognitive reserve not only struggling with rich intellectual issues, but also being culturally competent. It's important for young people and adults to be able to learn with and to listen to and empathize with each other, to respect each other and to care about each other. That's where you want the cognitive reserve to go, both into academic struggle and into collaboration with other human beings, not in trying to fit into environments. Third, we want to use the resources efficiently and maximize their effectiveness. And that is not just organizational and material resources, it's even the natural resources in our environment.
One of the things that I've also found fascinating is learning more about what you are defining as well-being and what you're defining as thriving. It strikes me that in how you bring these together, there's certain nuances that we need to pay attention to. How would you define them?
Rich, I'm going to draw on the work that Karen Pittman and I have done together. Thriving is the capacity of human beings, both individually and collectively, collectively as members of families, of communities, to experience well-being, groundedness, and agency, and to have those experiences both individually and collectively, and for those experiences and the perceptions related to those experiences to be occurring both in the moment but over time, and for all of that to happen in every life domain, not just the cognitive domain, but the social domain, in terms of their health, et cetera, et cetera. Thriving is more than well-being, even though well-being, physical well-being, and mental well-being are very important. Well-being is foundational. It's what we all need, just like we need a sufficient amount of food and we need shelter. What Maslow talks about. Those things are basic, and I think well-being is foundational for thriving, but at the same time, we also need to be grounded. We need to feel connected. We need to know that we stand in connection with people in our past, that we move towards a future that we can envision, that we are connected to the people around us. And that we also need to know that we matter, not just because of who we are, but because we matter to others, both in terms of their feelings about us, but because we are also bonded to them and we affect them. Some Native American communities talk about the seven generations. Seven generation thinking is the type of historical groundedness that I'm talking about, where we feel connected to our past, connected to a future, and have a sense of purpose. There are lots of elements to groundedness. It includes the experiences of feeling that you're a member of a community, that you belong. It's also the good things that go with feelings that you belong and that people care about you. People also need the capacity to act in their environment, to both act individually and to act collectively. That's one of the things that our organism has, the ability to use our mind and to use our social creations, our relationships with each other, to address challenges and to create together. Now, often people live in places that challenge our well-being, that challenge our sense of connectedness, that challenge our sense that we can do something. But we know from history, and I'm a historical sociologist by professional training, that even in harsh circumstances, people have the ability to teach and nurture each other and to create well-being for themselves and for others. And we also know that people have the ability to act on their environment, to act ethically, to take on challenges, and to do something to address those challenges. To me, that's what thriving's about. It's about a foundation of well-being. It's about being grounded. It's about being agentic. It's about not being alone. It's about all the aspects of one's life cohering, both in the moment, but also over time. Let me add one more thing about thriving. It's about optimization. It's not about narrow goals. And I think what we've done as a society is we have both badly defined equity, and then we create and measure mediocre goals and standards that we create in order to assess equity. When I talk about mediocre outcomes, it's not that some things that are minimal aren't important. Being on track is important. It's just not sufficient. It's just not meaningful alone. It's not sufficiently powerful to make a life. Transformation and thriving involves having the experiences and skills that enable you to transform your own life. That's what's represented by deeper learning rather than shallow learning. That's what's represented when we enable everyone to develop their capacity to be creative and to experience awe. That's what happens when we decide that we're not just going to enable young people to develop their basic skills, but to understand the importance of those skills and to use those skills in a self-directed manner because they're metacognitive about how they can use those skills.
David, the first set of episodes are explicit, but then the balance of our episodes explain that there's a science of learning and development. At times, I've thought that you were speaking of this as a balance of learning and development, but you don't. How do you speak of that?
Rich, last week I attended a UNESCO meeting on the science of learning. And there was a very interesting discourse split between two groups of people who work in the science of learning. There's one group of people who really study the brain as a computer, and they really treat the brain as being essentially disembodied. And there's another group of people who study the science of learning in ways that understand that the brain is embodied, that human beings have a mind, that they have a body. And they also have something that works like a computer. But all those things have to work together. Learning and development are integrated. You can't have one without the other. The human being grows because it learns. Some of that learning ends up being cognitive, but some of it is non-cognitive. It happens in the body. The organization learns from its environment and transforms itself in response to that environment. Now, that learning, both the learning that is cognitive as well as the learning that is non-cognitive, can be both healthy and good and productive and ethical, or it could be the opposite. Part of the challenge for us is to make sure that learning is not only powerful and good, but it is healthy. At the same time, we can't make it powerful or good if we don't address its social and emotional and cultural components. At the same time, not only is development dependent on learning, but learning is dependent on all those aspects of people's being that we think about in terms of development. Let's think about what it's like to try to learn when you're hungry, when you have a nasal cold, when you're asthmatic, when you have dental issues that are not being addressed. These are issues that people who grow up in poverty often face. How does that affect their ability to handle the task of learning? Now, some of them are able to do it well. But no matter what they're facing limits what they can do, because in order to suppress the feelings of hunger, the pain that they're feeling, they have to use cognitive reserve as well as emotional reserve that ought to be available for the learning process. And just as we can't think about development without learning, we can't think about learning without development.
David, you're talking about incredibly complex ideas and trying to apply them in an environment where people are saying, we just want kids to learn how to read and write and do arithmetic. Times certainly have changed, and we're also now talking about AI. How does all of this come together in the science of learning and development?
So, Rich, there are many research-based examples that I could provide to you. Let me give you one that I heard today, and it's about an organization that I've studied for many years, Communities in Schools. Rav Chetty and his team just concluded a 20-year longitudinal study of communities in schools in Texas that involved millions of students. And they were able to show that the impact, and I mean here impact because this was an impact study, of students having site coordinators who provided relational support and coordination closed achievement gaps, raised graduation rates, boosted college enrollment, and raised lifetime earnings by $75,000 per student. That's not a correlational finding, it's an impact finding. Relationships and student support matter. What also matters is the fact that young people, particularly today, are going to be confronting an environment where they have to be able to be creative and self-generative because the fact that the basic things they are learning in school can often be done more efficiently and more cheaply by AI. What we need is to be preparing young people so they can creatively adapt to all the challenges that are going to happen in their lifetime, and at the same time, to be able to find ways in which they can be meaningfully employed in a way that's good for themselves as human beings, good for their children, good for their families, and good for their communities.
David, you've structured the 35 episodes into a series of arcs. What is the first arc, and how would you describe what you're trying to achieve?
Season one is foundational. The first episode focuses on why the National Academy of Education commissioned three papers to address the impact of COVID and its wake on learning, well-being, and equity. And we will hear from two past presidents of the Academy who were very involved in these papers, as well as Governor Barb Wise, who was an education-oriented governor of West Virginia and a major leader nationally, and Scott Palmer, who is the managing partner of Education Council and also of the Science of Learning and Development Alliance, who will help us understand how do we address the politicization of evidence when we have good evidence and we have good knowledge, but people need to access them. The second episode involves the three papers, and we'll hear from one of the authors of each of the three papers to really help listeners understand why those papers are important and how they can use them. We will also hear from Joe Bishop and Karen Pittman, who are two very influential national practitioners who will really talk about how the implications of these papers don't only speak to schools, they also speak to communities and to the community-wide learning ecosystem. The third session is a keynote conversation with John King. Current Chancellor of SUNY, served as Deputy Commissioner and then Commissioner of Education in New York State, past Secretary of Education, and the person who had created Roxbury Academy, on the important role that teachers can play in supporting the emotional well-being of young people, which is central to their academic well-being. We will then have a deep dive, which is the first of many deep dives we'll have, with one person who is knowledgeable in an area to really help us understand it. And that person is Karen Pittman. And the focus of that conversation will be on the evolution of thinking about positive youth development and our understanding of learning ecosystems and of youth thriving. We will then hear from important researchers who focus on the science of learning and development. Mary Helen Imodina Yang, a neuroscientist who reminds us that learning happens because people have emotions, not in spite of emotions. And Stephanie Jones, who wrote a very important article on bringing developmental science back into education, along with Jim Pellegrino and Carol Lee, both of whom have played important roles in learning science, but both of whom understand the fact that learning science doesn't work if it does not focus also on culture and on development. And finally, we will conclude this first season by focusing on the conditions for learning, well-being, and thriving by hearing from Zureida Hammond and Kim Schonert-Reichel and Naila Nasir and Megan Bang.
There's a